Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, the speaker is Stephen Zunis. He will be speaking on the U.S. role in Israel and Palestine. So let's listen in on Stephen Zunis.
I understand because in the media is a two-edged sword. And that, on the one hand, I think the media asks more critical questions than they used to, on certain levels. But on the other hand, the propaganda is so easily disseminated. And for example, around the Gulf War, the censorship at the front, the only version Americans saw of the war was the U.S. version. And supposedly in the name of national security, they would censor things about civilian casualties in Iraq and even silly things like the when they talk about the pilots coming back in environment being giddy, they censor that and substitute the word proud. Mm-hmm. Or the fact that maybe pilots would watch pornographic videos for just before their missions. They thought that would be a national security breach if they mentioned that. And so they censored that. Now it's interesting, the highest, you look at the Gulf War, the highest percent of people who support the war the most were in two categories. People who knew least about the Middle East, people who watched the most television coverage of the war. But what was, it's more disturbing in many respects than the censorship itself, is that not only did a large majority of Americans support the censorship, but a majority thought the media should have been censored more. Because remember when occasionally CNN came in with pictures of civilian casualties or something, people just blasted CNN and their correspondent and stuff. Peter Arnett for daring to even show that we were killing civilians.
They had this one clip where they were showing how they were torturing women. Mm-hmm. And later it was found that this woman that they took a picture was posing. She was paid to pose for this picture.
Yeah, a lot of stuff. For example, the story about the Iraqis throwing the babies out of incubators and stuff, that was all fabrication. In fact, the supposed nurse that testified with that happened to be the niece of the Kuwaiti ambassador, and the people in the congressional committee knew her because they met her at diplomatic receptions, but they still didn't reveal. In fact, she wasn't really a nurse, she was making this stuff up.
But they can go to war using some dumb thing like that for an excuse.
Yeah.
I mean, just anything.
Yeah, it's a matter, you know, I think the reason I found the Institute was just to try to give some alternative perspectives. And occasionally, I've been on National Public Radio a couple times, and then non-bid pieces in the Christian Science Monitor and other publications. So I, do some of that occasionally. Why don't we go ahead? It looks like there's going to be an intimate group today. So,
one person coming.
Okay. Your name and where you're from and what particular interests you have in this broader topic, and some indication of what previous discussions I'm glad to have that you've attended, if any.
I'm Eleanor Rohr. I'm from Whidbey Island, and this is my third one. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go to Israel next year. I want to get my background in that part of the world.
I'm Marianne Cross from Vancouver, BC. It's nice to hear something that's not on television.
And I'm Helen Carlson from Spokane, Washington. And this is my third one.
I'm Ryan Narzisi from Woodinville, Washington. This is my third one. And I hope to be a photojournalist. It sounds like the Mideast is kind of a hotbed. That would be kind of a cool place for me to go.
Yeah, that's pictures. Cool.
We got some pretty incredible shots in town. Great. Introductions? Name, where you're from, and why you're here?
Name, rank, and serial number. Tell us why you're here.
Okay, I guess I'll begin now. I wanted to, just a brief overview of what the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is about. Is basically two competing nationalisms, and one can argue endlessly about the legitimacy of one or the other, but the reality is that they both exist, at least in the minds of the people involved, and are unstoppable. And you're not going to convince Israeli Jew that they have no right to existence. Israelis, you're not going to convince a Palestinian Arab they don't have any right to exist in Palestine. And so that push for national self-determination is there. And the Jews not give up about their dream of statehood after 2,000 years. The Palestinians not going to give up after 40. Just as the Jews apparently were not safe in their diaspora as minorities, Palestinians have certainly been finding out the same thing in Jordan and Lebanon and Kuwait and other places. The Arabs have moved quite a bit, and you know, recognizing that Israel exists and they have to deal with that. PLO is in Egypt, have already recognized that Israel, in the case of the PLO, is unilateral. For a long time, the PLO said, we'll recognize you if you recognize us. The Israeli said, no. So the PLO went ahead and recognized Israel anyway. Other Arab states are real close. Or in fact, even any day now, Jordan may formally recognize Israel. There is a growing consensus that it should be a two-state solution. That is, a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, Israel and its internationally recognized borders, and some special status for Jerusalem. And the only real holdouts to that, agreeing to that, are a few extremist Middle Eastern states like Iran, Libya, and some of the radical Islamic movements on one end that don't recognize Israel's existence, and on the other extreme, Israel and the United States, which refuse to recognize Palestine. And virtually every country in the world either openly supports a two-state solution or recognizes the Palestinian state, which was declared some years ago, but doesn't really have much territory to speak of, and Israel. But, or is at least open to that possibility. I mean, for example, the Canadian government has never formally recognized Palestinian independence, but they haven't really been in the forefront of calling for Palestinian rights, but they've never, unlike the United States, have never opposed the idea. Palestinian state would certainly not be a threat to Israel. Assuming it existed, we're talking about a tiny country that would be largely demilitarized probably as a result of a treaty. And not to mention the fact that even if it was hypothetically a threat, if you said, well, people don't have a right to self-determination because they might hypothetically be a threat to a neighboring state, you'd have countries canceling each other out all over the world. Indeed, Israel is one of the most powerful and well-trained and well-commanded armed forces in the world. I mean, they're already more powerful than any combination of Arab states. So the idea that a Palestinian mini-state might be a threat to Israel militarily is ludicrous on face value. Yet that's what you hear President Clinton and 90% of U.S. Congress saying repeatedly and often in the media. And it's basically an excuse to deny people right to self-determination. In fact, U.S. policy, by not recognizing Palestinian rights, is a rejecting, because it's no longer an issue of Israel versus Palestine, since Palestine's agreed to two states. It's basically the idea of continued military rule of some sort, even under quasi-autonomy, or freedom and independence. So in effect, what the U.S. is doing has been as a rejection of Wilsonian principles of self-determination, which have been the cornerstone of international law and, in theory, U.S. foreign policy for most of the century. This occupation of 2 million people over these 25 years or more is very expensive and diplomatically very difficult. Indeed, for a small country to maintain, that, like Israel, which only has like 4 million people, to maintain occupation over large amounts of Arab lands and civilians, they only do it because they get a lot of outside support. The U.S. last year sent over $4.4 billion of direct foreign aid to Israel, in addition to a $2 billion installment of a $10 billion loan guarantee, in addition to another $2 billion or so of tax-deductible private contributions from American citizens that goes directly to the Israeli government. It's the only country that has this kind of arrangement. And its aid is unconditional. Like, for example, Egypt gets quite a bit of foreign aid from the United States. But basically, almost by dollar, they say what it can be used for. For example, this amount of money should be used to buy American wheat shipped by American shippers. And, you know, it's basically a subsidy for agribusiness or whatever. But it's basically, you know, basically you have officials from the Agency for International Development there overseeing about where pretty much every dollar spent. I mean, some gets wasted, but, you know, generally, they know where the money's going, more or less. Israel essentially blank check to the government. No other country is like that. This comes out to about $1,400 per Israeli man, woman, and child, on average. It's the most generous arrangement between two countries in history. I mean, per capita, this is more than what the Soviet Union gave Cuba during the height of their relationships, more than the U.S. even gave to South Vietnam during the Vietnam War.
What is that? Some kind of an agreement then between the United States?
Well, it's every year it's passed as part of the foreign aid bill. And to my knowledge, there's never been any real debate on it. It's generally accepted. Very little debate.
It sure be nice to put all that money in the foreign debt there.
Yeah. But economically, it's just one piece of it. The United States has repeatedly vetoed United Nations Security Council resolutions calling on Israel to uphold certain standards of international law involving things like the destruction and confiscation of Arab property, building illegal settlements, bombing raids against civilian targets, continued occupation, etc. Sometimes the U.S. supports them, often it's neutral, but even ones that they support, the U.S. is blocking any kind of sanctions that might enforce them, so they're just, they generally can be ignored. In fact, the U.S. has cast its veto on resolutions critical to Israel during the past 25 years. More than all vetoes by all members of the Security Council on all other issues combined. When Yasser Arafat several years ago wanted to come before the United Nations General Assembly and talk about his willingness to make peace with Israel, the U.S. refused to allow him into the country, even though the U.S. is required with its agreement by the U.N. to make that possible. In fact, the whole U.N. General Assembly had to go to Geneva and meet there. That's the only way they could, and Arafat was recognized as the head of state. The United States threatened to cut off all funds to the World Health Organization. The United States supplies 25% of WHO's budget if they allow Palestine as a member. And the Palestinian government exiles work very closely to WHO and quite responsibly in terms of medical things in the refugee camps and that kind of thing. But basically, we've been willing to, you know, stop. I mean, the impact it would have on AIDS, education, prevention, and childhood inoculation, or rehydration programs for starving children. Millions of people would have died if the U.S. had cut off aid. Yet the U.S. was willing to cut off aid rather than have Palestine be part of the World Health Organization. The U.S. Congress several years ago passed a resolution that that Palestinians have a small information office in Washington, D.C. And basically the U.S. Congress passed a bill, supported by the President, which closed down that office, made it illegal. So that Palestinians aren't even allowed to give their side of the story. It was called a Prevention of Terrorism Act. And this was passed by the same Congress that was arming the Contras, which killed far more civilians than PLO ever has in its entire history. Even back in the days when they were doing terrorism, the mainstream PLO has not been tied to an act of terrorism for more than 15 years. They also tried to close down the PLO mission to the UN, both the Federal Court and the International Court of Justice, so they couldn't do that because it was a foreign mission as part of the UN agreement. And they consistently denied any PLO official a visa to come to the United States, the other side of the story. Even moderate PLO people who'd never been tied to terrorism, who'd always supported recognition of Israel. Meanwhile, the U.S. routinely gave visas to extreme right-wing Israelis like Meir Kahani, who came to the United States to recruit people for his terrorism, including Bert Goldstein, who was an American who was responsible for that terrible massacre at the mosque in Hebron. Indeed, they made a law that anyone who received anything of value from the PLO, in return, for example, giving a speech representing them on a debate, would go to jail. So the U.S. position is real clear, and I could go on, but there was widespread, strong anti-Palestinian sentiment in virtually all these things were passed by a good 89% of the vote in Congress, including some of the more outspoken liberals on other issues.
Did we do that just because we didn't want to admit that we were wrong? I know the U.N. created Israel, mm-hmm. but we were basically the U.N. after World War II. So did we just want to not admit that we were wrong in doing this and just taking the Palestinians out? Or
The Palestinians, I'll talk about some of the reasons. And if I don't address that question directly in my prepared remarks, we can talk about the question next period. But basically, you know, why is this a strong anti-Palestinian pro-Israel bias, and why are we so unusual in the rest of the world? Again, I'd say we're about the only few countries in the world that don't support the international consensus for a two-state solution. First of all, I don't think it's moral. I mean, that's the thing we always hear, that there's this poor, struggling democracy about to be wiped out by the Arab hordes. Of course, that's ridiculous. They're even stronger than any combination of Arab armies. But also, if this is true, you'd see U.S. military aid in particular being very high when Israel was first created in 1948, when its institutions were, when its democratic institutions were strongest and its viability most threatened. But instead, if you look at the trend of USA, it's become just the opposite. 99% of all U.S. military aid to Israel came after 1967, when it invaded parts of all those neighboring countries and proved itself more powerful than any combination of Arab armies. Indeed, I've tracked the aid, you know, when aid would go up in little jumps, and the more powerful Israel has become, and the more repressive it's become, the more U.S. aid. And then again, it's just the opposite trend you'd expect if it was based on moral grounds. So I don't think it's out of some moral, ethical attachment for Israel's survival. I mean, I think a lot of individual Americans feel that, but I don't think that's why, you know, Congress or the President pushes this. I don't think it's because of the so-called Jewish vote. But practically as many Arab Americans and Muslim Americans as there are Jewish Americans. Again, the percentage of Jewish Americans is actually declining in the 45 years since Israel was created. And Jews are more and more divided about Israeli policies and U.S. support for those policies. So again, the trend's in the opposite direction, if that was the explanation. I don't even think it's the so-called Jewish lobby or political action committees. I mean, they got a lot of money. I mean, put in like maybe $8 million in the last election campaign. But basically, U.S. foreign policy is not that pluralistic. Usually, U.S. foreign policy is made by a bipartisan elite, so generally out of the reach of lobbyists. Now, if there's a mass movement, like the anti-Vietnam War movement or something, they'll feel the pressure. But even lobbying groups, even fairly powerful ones, generally don't have that kind of impact. They do have impact in Congress, but Congress usually doesn't make foreign policy. Congress is usually reactive. Most of congressional resolutions have been fairly symbolic in nature or parallel to what the administration was already doing. Besides, the so-called Jewish lobby has not been able to stop massive arms shipments to Arab states, or stop the ban on Jewish immigration from Eastern Europe, just as anti-Semitism to come on the rise, or stop Reagan from visiting that SS cemetery in Pittsburgh, or, you know, you can go down a whole list of things that the U.S. does, which most Jews would object to, and they haven't been able to stop those. They seem powerful because they parallel where the real interests are. Well, so I would argue that the reason the U.S. supports Israel is for strategic reasons. Israel's been able to suppress radical nationalist movements, not just among Palestinians, but in countries like Jordan and Lebanon and Yemen as well. They have been able to send arms and advisors to support pro-Western regimes and support pro-Western insurgencies throughout the world. They've been able to send U.S. arms to third parties that the U.S. could not send arms to directly for political reasons, like South Africa or Iran or Guatemala or the Contras. Their Secret Service and our CIA have collaborated extensively in intelligence gathering covert operations. They've offered battlefield testing for American weaponry, often against Soviet weaponry. During the Cold War, they kept pro-Soviet regimes like Syria in check. And their military-industrial complex and ours is very closely interlinked in manufacturing everything from new jet fighters and anti-missile defense systems and even Star Wars research and technology. And that's not changed, really, since the end of the Cold War. Because most of those issues are still relevant to this day. But what's interesting is that it sort of parallels historic anti-Semitism. By that I mean, if you look at the way Jews were treated, for example, in medieval Europe, it was like the ruling elites who set up the Jews to be kind of the visible agents of an oppressive social order, the moneylenders, tax collectors, middle-level managers. When people would rise up against the economic injustices, the elites could say, hey, don't blame us, it's the Jews. And people would turn their wrath on the Jews and these pogroms and that sort of thing, and Jews would flee to another country, and the whole cycle would start over again, culminating, of course, in the Holocaust. And in many ways, the idea of Zionism, of Israel, was that Jews could have their own nation state and no longer be dependent on the whims of the ruling elites. What has happened tragically is this has been perpetuated on a global scale. So you have British and French, when they wanted to get rid of Nasser in Egypt in 1956, they sent in the Israelis. And the ways I've just described, the U.S. is using Israel in similar ways. And so then you find these reactionary Arab regimes, instead of, you know, admitting that the problems have to do with their own autocratic rule or their ties with multinational oil companies or an unjust international economic order, will say to the people, hey, it's the Zionists, it's the Jews, it's the Israelis that are causing your problems. And basically, you have, I mean, even here in the United States, I've talked to officials of the U.S. government, members of Congress, and their aides, and they've said, oh, we understand why you think we should be concerned about human rights and entirety of human rights, but, you know, we can't help it as rich Jews. You know, we need, you know, my boss wants to get elected, we need that money. So in other words, we are responsible for our actions as rich Jews behind the scene manipulating stuff. Again, classic anti-Semitic scapegoating. You have American diplomats who have tell foreign leaders, hey, we understand your position, but those rich Jews are actually running things in Washington, D.C., and we're not responsible for our actions. Once again, blaming the Jews. Clearly we have a problem that's many familiar to those. People talk about how the Middle East is so complicated, but those of you who know about foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy in Central America or elsewhere, know that it's not unusual to support repressive allied governments to try to stomp out, you know, popular revolutionary movements. One of the big differences is I don't think it's as much really, again, that of a pro-Israel lobby, is that there has not been much in the way of an opposition to this policy. Now, I don't mean that in terms of public opinion. Public opinion in the United States has shown consistently that a majority of Americans support, or at least are open to the idea of Palestinian statehood, Palestinian state alongside Israel. Most Americans believe that U.S. aid to Israel should be conditioned on ending their pattern of gross and systematic human rights violations, or recognizing Palestinian rights, you know, withdrawing from occupied territories, etc. Even a majority of Jews support Palestinian statehood now. A Canadian Jews, according to a recent poll, support Palestinian statehood. But this is not reflected by those who really have the power. Again, if you look at Congress, there are less members of the U.S. Congress that support Palestinian statehood than there are members of the Israeli Knesset. And Congress is five times bigger than the Knesset, four times larger than the Knesset, or five times, if you count the Senate. Some of the most outspoken liberals in American politics, and we're talking about Tom Harkin and Ted Kennedy and Carol Moseley Braun and Paul Simon, Alan Cranston and Patty Murray, and you know, you go down the list, and you know, they are you know, to the right of the Israeli government. I think the Israelis are giving away too much in this autonomy agreement. All six Democratic candidates for president in 1988 or 1992 attacked George Bush from the right on his Middle East policy, saying we should be giving Israel even more. For example, you may remember there's a proposed $10 billion loan guarantee to Israel, and Bush said, and most Americans, according to polls, said we should condition this on Israel not withdrawing and not oppressing people, et cetera, et cetera. A minority, but a very large one, said, let's give them the loan, but only if we stop building these new illegal settlements. That was the position President Bush supported. And something like 10 or 15% are small right-wing minorities that also give the aid totally unconditional. All six candidates for president among the Democrats, Jerry Brown, Tom Harkin, Bill Clinton, all of them support this unconditional aid. So did, you know, all major candidates for U.S. Senate in the United States, etc. And the grounds were that it was to be housing for Soviet refugees. Well, I've been to Israel. They have a housing surplus there. In Beersheba, which is where most of the Soviet emigres come in, they got 5,000 empty units in that one town. You know, this is basically a ruse to try to, you know, bankroll the occupation. Indeed, it's not just among elected members of Congress, but you'll find that Jane Fonda and Tom Hayden, supposed to be real left-wingers, and et cetera, and anti-war people. In 1982, during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, where as many as 18,000 civilians were killed by Israeli bombs, Jane Fonda toured with the Israeli equivalent of the USO, and Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda were praising the invasion and supporting it in speeches around the country, and opposing Palestinian rights, saying anybody who supports Palestinian rights is a stooge of the oil companies. Similarly, you know, people, you know, a lot of other people, what's his name, Harry Britt, who's a vice chair of the Democratic Socialist of America, who's a progressive city councilman in San Francisco, is the head of the campaign against a proposition in San Francisco that supported a two-state solution. And you'll find, I can just go on and on, that this is, that among elites, even liberal elites, and there is virtually no support for Palestinian rights. This is not too unusual on one level, because, you know, liberals have rarely led. I mean, most liberals support the Vietnam War, initially. Most liberals oppose divestment from South Africa, initially. Most liberals oppose a nuclear freeze, initially. Most liberals support nuclear power, initially. But they change only because there were mass movements that essentially gave them no choice. Well, where's that mass movement? There's an enormous amount of timidity, I think, in the intellectual organizing sources of such movements, and that is in community-based peace and human rights groups and the mainline churches. Virtually all mainline churches, including the Lutherans, are part of the international consensus, you know, two-state solution and curbing arms transfers to the region. Committee on Human Rights has a fairly progressive platform there. But it's never been that big a priority. I mean, people have really not really gotten into this the way that they did, say, the sanctuary movement or stuff around Central America, or things around disarmament, or things around anti-apartheid thing, kind of efforts. Groups like the Committee for New Foreign Policy, Coalition for New Foreign Policy, which was a coalition of the mainline churches and peace and human rights groups in Washington, D.C., addressed every part of the world in U.S. foreign policy and refused to address the Middle East at all. I've been on the board of Washington State Saint Free's, also known as Peace Action of Washington, the largest statewide group dealing with peace issues in the United States. And there's been an incredible reluctance to address Middle East issues at all. Meanwhile, on the more far left, or, you know, those who are traditionally the real bulk of kind of third world solidarity movements, you have some very strong extremists that think the PLO is selling out by making peace with Israel. They just assume to see Israel wiped off the map. That's the support of terrorism. And often a lot of the sort of pro-Arab groups are themselves either made up of odd coalitions of people from the Marxist-Leninist left or from fairly conservative elements. I have given this example a couple of my talks, I think it's a classic one, of going to a meeting of the Palestine Human Rights Campaign, their annual convention, and they do very good work in terms of supporting human rights, and I support their efforts. But just at the table I was, there was someone who said the Palestine Human Rights Campaign should make an alliance with the Liberty Lobby, which is the extreme right-wing neo-fascist group that denies the Holocaust ever happened. Another one was wearing a South African Kruger amp, a gold coin of the apartheid regime around her neck. I couldn't help but think, why are these people here, really? Indeed, many of the most outspoken critics of Israel are those who are not doing it out of the reason I think many of us here would be critical of Israel, as we care about human rights, international law, and that kind of thing, because it's the world's only Jewish state, and Israeli governments over the years have provided them lots of excuses to jump on this one state. You know, they have no problems about human rights violations in the Arab countries, or human rights violations among U.S. allies in Latin America, or Asia or wherever. And so I think what has happened, I think one reason that perhaps the churches and the peace movement have been timid about this is because we're afraid of being confused with these other guys. We don't want to unawarely encourage anti-Semitism. I mean, I'm so glad that the peace has come, justice and peace has come to South Africa. I'm glad that there's the end of the fighting in Central America. I mean, these are good things. But at the same time, I would not have been, you know, I wouldn't have been too upset. You know, I mean, if the hunters were overthrown and the South African white government was, you know, lost all out as opposed to negotiated settlement, I wouldn't be too upset, to be frank. Whereas if the PLO marched into Tel Aviv armed, I'd be a little nervous. What I'm saying here is that it's a little more complex because we're talking about two historically oppressed groups here. It's a double-edged sword. You don't want to say, it's not the kind of thing you can reduce to a bumper sticker, really. I mean, it's easy for me to put a bumper sticker in my car, and I had bumper stickers on my car that said, "Stop Aid El Salvador." You know, and people reading that say, "Oh, this person doesn't like the idea of tax dollars being used to support death squads and massacres and that kind of thing." And you know, that was pretty straightforward. I knew it would be misinterpreted. You know, somebody might even people who supported Aid to the junta said, "Well, yeah, they're killing a lot of people. They're just better than communists." But you know, whatever. People knew where I was coming from. Whereas if I said, "Stop Aid to Israel," you wouldn't know where I was coming from necessarily. A lot of Jews, even Jews that oppose Israeli government policies and support Palestinian statehood, would think, where's that guy coming from, really? Is this one of these guys that cut into Israel but keep arming Saudi Arabia? Who would, you know, in the minute, again, given that many, you know, Jews assume that still are with this fiction that Israel's about to be wiped off the map, they're saying, "Oh, that person wants my people slaughtered. They want Israel destroyed. Why else would they want to leave Israel defenseless?"
Similarly, when we say let's support Palestinian statehood, again, that seems pretty straightforward to, you know, I can say freedom for Namibia, you know. Mm-hmm. Namibia should no longer be occupied by South Africa, there should be a free state of Namibia. Again, I don't think I had a bumper sticker, I think I had a button that said that at one point. But say that with Palestinian statehood now, again, for many Jews, that would be seen as, oh, you want Israel wiped out because the terrorist would use this little jumping off point and Israel would be wiped off the map and da da da. So it's an area that is where people are, I think, you know, the churches and mainline peace groups have been a little reluctant to take on because we don't like our Jewish friends yelling at us. We don't like being misinterpreted. We don't want to unawarely encourage anti-Semites. We don't want to support the justice for one people at the expense of another. And this is where I think people start talking about, oh, it's confusing. And one reason I found my institute is to try to, and I go around to groups, including some churches, doing workshops. Okay, how can we get involved on this issue in such a way that it doesn't end up having us misinterpreted? Now, what can we do that can, where we can be as passionate about changing U.S. policy and ensuring justice for the Palestinians and the people oppressed, while at the same time not threatening Israel or making it look like we're threatening Israel? And we don't have time. I don't have time to go into this in too much detail, unfortunately, because I've already talked more than I wanted to. But just real briefly, I think we need to be neither overwhelmed by these complexities into inaction, nor to pretend that there aren't these. There isn't a degree of special sensitivity we have to utilize in addressing this issue. I think what it comes down to is recognizing that U.S. policy is ultimately not pro-Israel. Because Israel will be far more secure with a Palestinian state on its borders than it will trying to keep, you know, 2 million people down, even in a quasi-autonomous situation. Israel's ties with the U.S. keeps it separate from the rest of the Middle East. Most Israelis are Middle Eastern. These are some Sephardic Jews. These are Middle Eastern, dark-skinned, third-world peoples. Their leaders are mostly European ancestry, but most Israelis are Middle Eastern, culturally and linguistically and otherwise. They're Semites, like the Arabs. Cousins, both descendants of Abraham. Can you imagine what the Middle East would look like with a combination of Israeli technology, Palestinian industriousness, and Arabian oil wealth? Might not be great for our oil companies or Pentagon or arms manufacturers, but it would be great for people there. And to basically see how, and even U.S. aid to Israel, you know, I use this figure $1,400 per Israeli. Israelis don't get that. Virtually all of it goes back to the United States to support the U.S. arms industry or to pay interest to American banks on previous loans. It's basically a continuation of Reaganomics. Take money from the middle-class taxpayer and give it to the arms makers and bankers. Only this time we can blame the Jews for it. Indeed, for an interesting thing for Israel, it could cost Israel, every dollar of U.S. military aid to Israel costs Israelis $2 to $3 in spare parts, training, personnel, etc. It's actually a drain on their economy. It hurts them.
Do they know that?
Some do. Well, yeah, I mean, the statistics are there. I mean, just like statistics are out there that says U.S. military spending is screwing us up, and a lot of people won't pay attention to it. I mean, if everybody knew how costly military spending was, no way to get away with it being as high as it is. I mean, U.S. military spending today is higher than it was during the 70s, the Cold War, even counting with real dollars. So the figures are out there, and letting people know, just like here, but you know, it's not common knowledge, unfortunately. because again, their elites in Israel would benefit from that. They have their own military-industrial complex that loves this relationship, despite what it's doing to the economy as a whole. That's why they need these bailouts, like this loan guarantee, etc. I think what real key is to emphasizing, if we talk to our Jewish friends or others, that again, it's ultimately anti-Israel as well. The goal is peace and justice. It's not an either-or kind of thing. In a sense, the United States is supporting Israel the way U.S. supported South Vietnam, support El Salvador, supporting a right militaristic elite, which could ultimately lead the country to its self-destruction. And I think if we take that tact, it will be a lot better. I think we need to be careful about what kind of alliances we make. Don't make sure we don't get tied in with some anti-Semites. I think it's real careful we reassure people that are committed to Israel's survival. But more guns and more brutal occupation doesn't necessarily enhance your likelihood of survival. In fact, it decreases it. You know, try to redefine security. But I think it's real important, again, we not be timid. You know, we don't let otherwise liberal politicians get away with this kind of thing. You know, I remember in the Tom Harkin campaign, people were, you know, for president, he was sort of the first choice. A lot of liberals, he's a senator from Iowa who was one of the leading contenders to the Democratic nomination. And people never questioned him about his Middle East policy, that he was the most right-wing of the lot. But if he'd been that right-wing on El Salvador or Nicaragua, no way could he have gotten away with it. There were people demonstrating his rallies and sit-in office and, you know, going through all sorts of stuff. I'm afraid that's what it's going to take, really. just that kind of pressure. And I think it's important because if people like us don't do that kind of pressure, we're going to leave it to the anti-Semites and the isolationists and the right-wingers to raise these questions. And it needs to be addressed as a peace issue or justice issue, not an Israel versus Arab kind of issue. So I could talk a lot more, this includes the specifics of Clinton's policy, but I guess I'd like to throw it wide open.
This Palestinian state, is it a kind of a state that will eventually could support themselves, or is this a poor?
Palestinians actually have a higher percentage of college graduates than do Israelis, and they're traditionally very industrious people. They have not been traditionally nomadic. They are traditionally agrarian towns, traders, townspeople. They are poor now because the Israeli occupation has destroyed their economy, but they could rebound pretty quick. And most of the West Bank and Gaza is, well, not lush and green. It's certainly not desert either. I mean, it's agriculturally quite viable. There's tourist industry, of course, because Bethlehem and most of Jerusalem and the holy sites would be part of this Palestinian state, presumably. And indeed, actually, the most of Galilee that's in Israel proper is largely populated by Palestinians. Nazareth is an Arab town, Christian Arabs, even though it's in Israel itself. So I think there's a, it's certainly, you know, not, you know, by North American standards it would be poor, but by third world standards it'd actually be better off than most. Indeed, if we gave them just a fraction of the aid we're giving to Israel, they'd be great.
Well, would other Arab states help Palestine?
Yeah, presumably oil states and others. And you know, just with peace there, there'll be much more trade between the Arab states and Israel, things like that. And the Palestinians have traditionally been, you know, middlemen and traders, and would probably do quite well. And they also were generally under occupation. Most of them speak Hebrew now, or at least the more educated people. So they could be the intermediate. You know, they're the one people that speak. Most of them speak Arabic and Hebrew, so they're obviously a middleman role there. So I think they do pretty well.
What is the church's stand on it, like the ELCA? I mean, I haven't heard a lot about it when I go to meetings and things. I mean, have they taken any stand?
Yeah, my understanding, I haven't actually read, I'm not Lutheran, so I haven't actually taken the time to read it, but my understanding is that at some point, some years ago, about the time the other mainland Protestant churches were doing it, they came out with a statement that basically supported the right of self-determination for both peoples. I mean, some general statement about human rights and curbing the arms trade, and you know. And the fact that you haven't heard of it and that you're active, I think is indicative that they haven't made it a big priority. But the basis of action is there, to be sure. The Quakers, I think, were the first to come out with a comprehensive statement back in 1971. They got all sorts of flack for it, but now it's pretty much the mainstream viewpoint. Now you have the right-wing Christian fundamentalists who basically think Israel should take over the whole Middle East and the Messiah will come. And indeed, the most vocal supporters of Israel have been, you know, Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and people like that. And it's ironic because most of them probably believe the Jew moved next door, but you know, they are, I mean, you know, a lot of their theology and other things I think I consider rather anti-Semitic, but you know, they are all for Israel. In fact, I wouldn't mind if most North American Jews moved up and went there, but you know.
Yes.
But they are very passionately anti-Palestinian, which is ironic since 20% of Palestinians are Christians. I mean, they're Christians that are being persecuted right now, who are supported by these religious broadcasters and right-wingers who are supporting the occupation. I think I told this, I think last night, an interesting story of in the Madrid peace talks, these right-wing American Christian fundamentalists were quoting biblical quotes, mostly out of context, you know, saying this should all be Israel, and, you know, and no Arab state have a right for any of this, and Palestinians. And then this Palestinian woman started going line by line in the Bible and debating them. And so it was Hanan Ashrari, who is the chief spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation at the peace talks. Ashrari is an Anglican, an Episcopalian, a devout one. She had a Bible.
But Torah doesn't mean anything to a Muslim, and the Quran doesn't mean anything to Jews. So by saying
no. In fact, no. The Torah, much of the Old Testament has been incorporated in the Quran, as has much of the Gospels. You know, Jesus and Abraham and Isaiah and Moses are all great prophets in Islam that are talked about quite a bit in Muslim tradition. But as I mentioned, a good 20% of the Palestinian population are Christians. In fact, many of them descendants of the original Christians. You know, famous story of a missionary who went there and started talking about the Jesus, and he noticed that the Arabs who were listening to him already knew about Jesus, and they said, "Oh, are you Christians?" Yeah, I'm Christian. How long is your family Christian? About 2,000 years. Just a word on Clinton's position is that U.S. policy up to this point has been that all the Israeli settlements were illegal. We weren't willing to, you know, condition aid to their being dismantled, but it's real clear. International law says you cannot transfer your population onto land seized by military force. And the UN have passed a number of resolutions supported by the U.S. generally saying that these settlements are illegal. Clinton administration is the first administration to refuse to call them illegal, refuse to call for their dismantling. Also, all previous administrations have seen East Jerusalem, which was the Arab part of Jerusalem that was seized by Israel in 1967, as part of the West Bank, which it is, but, you know, historically, geographically, everything else. The Clinton administration now basically has rejected and endorsed Israel's annexation. All previous administrations called the West Bank and Gaza occupied territories. Now the Clinton administration calls them disputed territories, implying that both sides have equal claim. So the Clinton administration is by far the most right-wing, hard-line administration we've ever had on the Middle East. Indeed, the people that Clinton appointed are essentially the equivalent of Reagan's appointments in Central America. I mean, I know some of these people prior to their appointments, the far right wing of the policy-making community. In fact, they identify more with the Cud government, which was the right-wing government that preceded the more moderate labor government that's currently in power. Because remember, the U.S. barred the PLO from taking part in the peace talks. The only way the peace talks got as far as it did was Israelis had to meet with the PLO secretly in a third country because the U.S. wouldn't allow the PLO to take part. So, you know, the U.S. is actually takes a more hardline position than the Israeli government. Clinton takes a more hardline position than Rabin and most of the Israeli government does right now. And unfortunately, the way the Oslo Accords were is that there's so many ambiguities, and Israel holds the cards in terms of actually holding on to the ground, to the land. It's not likely that the peace agreement will go beyond a kind of Palestinian Bantustan or a real, you know, where the Palestinians are in charge of garbage collections and marriage certificates, but you're not, nothing much real beyond that, which is, you know, far short of independence. Because right now, the way it is now, is Israelis, even in Gaza Strip, Israelis still hold one-third of the land outright, and the troops can intervene at any time, they can veto any law, they can veto any appointment. I mean, it's not even close to real self-determination. But it's not going to get any further than that unless Israel gets pushed. The only country that really has the power to push Israel is the United States, and the United States is basically takes the line that Israel's given away too much already, which could put the whole peace process in jeopardy. The U.S. blocked sending in a multinational peacekeeping force to protect the Palestinian civilian population after the Hebron massacre, even the Israelis expressed openness for it. Indeed, you know, the U.S. is, you know, look, some of these right-wing settlers, essentially the equivalent of the death squads in Central America, and up to a third of these right-wing settlers are American emigres, get supported by American private donations. And of course, the settlements themselves are built with huge subsidies, which are made possible only because of American aid. So we really do have the power to make a difference there. We've made a conscious choice not to. And I think it's time for some elected officials hear about that. If I voted solely on the Middle East, I would have voted for Bush. I mean, he was pretty bad. He was as bad as Clinton. Yeah.
Why do you think Clinton's policies were right than Bush's?
I think there are a couple factors. One is he really doesn't know that much about foreign policy in general, and so he leaves it to the experts. Pardon?
He didn't even know how to run Arkansas.
Yeah. But he does have a passion for certain domestic issues, but he's basically, well, actually, even that might be too generous. I'm speaking as someone who by and large, has thought the Clinton administration has done a lot of things better than the Bush administration, or previous Republican administration. That's just my own bias. But I still think that Clinton is basically amoral. I mean, he doesn't really have any convictions, and he sort of goes where, you know, goes where the pressure is, or like, whatever. And, you know, the establishment pressure, it takes this very hard line, so sure, you do that. And I think another factor is that, again, there's very little resistance to that kind of policy. I mean, for the reasons I have talked about, how the churches and the peace movement, human rights movements have been pretty quiet on this. I think another thing is that he has nothing to lose. You know, and people like myself and other people who identify with, you know, left of center politics aren't going to go vote for Republican just because Clinton's off the wall in the Middle East, even though this is an area that I care passionately about. I think another factor is, and I don't want to overstate this one because a lot of people do, is that indeed that certain elements of the Democratic Party have been influenced by well-heeled right-wing Jewish contributors. And again, I think people often overstate that, but it's not something that should be ignored either. It is a factor, to be sure. I think the fact that Congress isn't causing any resistance, that Congress is pressuring him to the right. And the United States abstained on two clauses of the UN resolution condemning the Hebron massacre, the one that referred to Jerusalem as part of the occupied territories, and the one that used the word occupied territories. But 78 members of Congress sent a resolution saying you should have vetoed the whole resolution, and just abstained on those two paragraphs. And that kind of gives you an idea of where people are coming from. So, you know, you have, so he's not gonna, and you know, Clinton's not gonna take a real principled stand on anything unless he thinks he can get political advantage of it, out of it. I'm sorry I'm being so cynical, but that's just my reading of it. It's kind of funny because, you know, I even though I have a fairly, though my own bias, I think, is to the left of a lot of my audience, is the fact that I'm so critical of Clinton makes Republicans happy too, so I can get away with it.
What do you know about Canada standing on a lot of this? Are we just kissing America and agreeing with absolutely everything?
No, there were a couple things. There was a big international conference about a decade ago in Vancouver? It was on the environment or something they had?
Habitat.
The Canadians refused to allow the PLO delegation to come in, even just to, you know, because even take part. So they've done things like that. They, like most countries, have essentially had an arms embargo on Israel since the 1967 war. So they haven't been arming directly.
The previous conservative government, they were supportive of moving the capital of Israel to Jerusalem.
Or moving the embassy to Tel Aviv.
That's right.
That which many people interpret as endorsing Israel's annexation. I think, except for El Salvador, maybe, or one or two small countries, all foreign countries have their embassies in Tel Aviv because, according to the UN, Jerusalem should still be an international city. So that would essentially be defying UN precedent and that kind of thing. But it was, some people thought it was a political capital, but of course, you've seen this in the United States, almost every candidate for president, even the ones who won, said we'll move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. But once they're in office, they realize it would, leave their nationals subjected to attacks by Islamic fundamentalists and could really all hell break loose. So they've never fallen through on it. And it's one of those issues, I think, that, for example, you are not going to choose your vote on where a particular candidate says the Canadian embassy in Israel should be. But there are certain segments of the Canadian population, the Jewish population, where that would be a decisive factor. So you go where, that's the way I think gun control in the United States is. There may be a tiny minority, there are a whole vote who are passionate gun lovers who will cast their vote on that, whereas even though large majority support gun control, they'll look at other issues. Abortion was like this for a long time as well, that the anti-abortion people were more single issue than the abortion rights people. When that changed, a lot of votes changed, when the other side started getting single issue. And maybe the side is going to have to get single issue on this stuff. Maybe we have to say to Tom Harkin or Patty Murray or people like that, if you're going to take these kind of positions, I'm going to sit this one out, or I'll vote for you, but I won't send you any money, or make this an issue, feel the heat from the other direction. I'm not sure. Largely because I think public education is my main thing, not political strategy per se. But also, I'm a 501c3 organization, tax deductible organization, so I can't lobby or take positions of candidates. But I think it's the kind of thing that's going to definitely require a hearing from people a lot more. But to my knowledge, the Canadian government